Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight-loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight-loss. PlushCare.com/weight-loss.
Welcome to the latest edition of the Football Writers Podcast, featuring me, Mike Calvin, Seb Stafford-Bloor from Tifo Football, and Adrian Clark, the tactical analyst. This is where things get serious. One-off matches in which the stakes couldn't be higher. The week begins with Europa League quarterfinals in Germany, but builds in intensity with the Champions League in Portugal. Only two former winners, Barcelona and Bayern, remain. They, of course, play one another on Friday. Aid, this competition is wide open, isn't it?
Yeah, and it couldn't be more exciting, in my opinion. The fact that we've got one-off games is a leveller of sorts. We've seen, haven't we, in the FA Cup, Arsenal, a clearly inferior team to Manchester City, turned them over in the semi-final, and then win as underdogs against Chelsea in the final. And the same can happen in this Champions League format on neutral ground, of course. So yeah, really, really wide open, tremendously exciting because there are only two previous winners left in the competition and they meet each other, which means there'll be one in the last four. It's set up, isn't it, to be a wonderful festival of football, even though there can't be any fans at that particular festival. So yeah, from a footballing perspective, I really can't wait for the coming days. Yeah, it's going to be a good climax to the season, I think.
Yeah, in essence, Seb, this is being staged like an international tournament, isn't it? You know, the schedule is very intense and condensed. There's a momentum of interest which will grow. Now, you know, with the fixture list at club level condensing, becoming ever more cluttered and congested, do you think we're almost seeing a future of football here? In other words, blocks of time where the top competition occurs at club level.
Yeah, I think we might, Mike. I think what will ultimately dictate it is the size of the audience and the great advantage at the moment. Obviously, of course, there's strange things going on in the world generally, but at the moment, these games are going to have a far higher audience than they would otherwise just because of the scarcity of live sport. I don't know whether we'll ever move to a full-time kind of Club World Cup model, as you say, but I think the future is almost certainly that Champions League games will migrate to the weekend. Because these blocks of fixtures, I think it's conducive to attracting as many people as possible. For instance, if you were to say, on an average Champions League group stage, you know, we're going to stagger our games from sort of midday on a Saturday, 2 o'clock, 4 o'clock, 6 o'clock, etc., across the weekend. I think that'd be a very attractive model to not just UEFA, but also to the big clubs. And as we're finding out with all sorts of things, when big clubs want something, they generally get it. And I expect that will be a concession UEFA make to them, at some point within the next decade.
Yeah, I can see that happening. I remember being at Barcelona about 18 months ago and talking to their top people. And the mood really was then, look, why can't we play this at weekend? So, yeah, I think you're probably right there. We talked about it being wide open and that Barca and Bayern are the only previous winners. Mm. How do you see that one going? I thought Barcelona looked really fragile against Napoli.
Yeah, I did too. I wasn't overly impressed with them. But when you've got Lionel Messi in your team, you always have a chance, don't you? And especially in a one-off game. But when you compare Barcelona tactically with Bayern Munich, a really, really well-oiled machine at the moment under Hansi Flick, they don't compare. Bayern do look streets ahead. So you have to make them the favourites for this game, no doubt about it. I mean, how impressive has this guy been, by the way? I mean, he inherited a team that weren't in great condition, and they now look like the best team in Europe by some distance. Maybe we'll find out over the coming days whether he is a good tactician or not, because they've just bullied teams, haven't they, over the last few months. Barcelona, yeah, they weren't convincing, were they? They looked a little bit open, I felt, and under Quique Setién, and they haven't settled yet. I think that much is fair to say. We don't really know what they're trying to achieve. So no, you would make Bayern the favourites, but the Messi factor can't be ignored.
Yeah, they certainly reminded Frank Lampard how far Chelsea have to go, don't they? You know, if you think of it, I think Chelsea have conceded 79 goals in all competitions in this season. That tells you everything, doesn't it, Seb?
I would say so, Mike. I mean, these are special circumstances. There are strange breaks between games, and you know, everybody's season has been disrupted. But I was amazed by the naivety in that Chelsea defence. I mean, even having watched the way they've defended through most of the season, I think they are. I've got big concerns. I mean, because obviously they spent an awful lot of money on the top half of their side, and they bought some very, very good players indeed, very expensive players. But you just wonder whether this is. Whether they've fallen into a little bit of a trap of their own making, whether they've actually underestimated one of their own weaknesses. That defence is dreadful, dreadful. I mean, some of these players, you know, a couple of them have aged, that's fair. A few of them are off form, but as a defence, as a unit in isolation, it belongs in mid-table at best. It's appalling. So unless they match their offensive spending in their back four and on their goalkeeper, they've got huge problems next season.
Yeah, no, I do agree on that. I think it's been a bit neglected. Zouma and Christensen should be nowhere near Chelsea agreed. First team, but it stems from the keeper. Surely, I know that Caballero's in at the moment, and you know he's not as blatantly bad as Kepa. But I think if you've got a truly elite goalkeeper behind a defence, it provides a lot more confidence and assurance. So that is issue number one. But then beyond that, yeah, they have to obviously upgrade the personnel, but also we said for ages that the left back position needed sorting from a defensive point of view. Clearly, two centre backs to replace the couple that I mentioned, a keeper, and then you've got ageing Azpilicueta, and then you've got Reece James who appears much better going forward than defensively. Although I think he's got capabilities to defend properly under the right coaching, and Frank. Maybe Frank needs to look at his coaching setup and maybe bring in someone to cope with the defenders. He and Jody Morris, clearly very good midfield players in their day, but maybe it just isn't their forte. I don't think Derby were that secure defensively under Lampard or Morris. I felt that was a slight weak link then. Maybe he needs to bring in somebody with vast experience, a former defender potentially. You could upgrade Ashley Cole. Or look elsewhere, I guess. So that's something to look at moving forwards.
John Terry?
JT won't work under Frank, will he? I don't see it.
There's too much ego there, isn't there?
The reason that there were whispers that he's leaving Aston Villa is because he feels he's outgrown that role. And he's the green-eyed monster at the moment, JT. He's looking at Frank Lampard. He's looking at Mikel Arteta. Looking at Steven Gerrard, and he's saying, well, I want a piece of this. I want to be a number two. So no, that won't happen.
I do love the hubris of John Terry thinking he's outgrown that role already. It's this kind of what Villa with their almost worst defensive record in the whole division. And all of a sudden it's kind of, it's time for me to get a Premier League manager's job. That's ridiculous.
Dean Smith's brought in Craig Shakespeare, hasn't he? So
Which I would have thought would hasten the exit of someone like John Terry. I'd have thought that would be a bruise to the ego. So
he didn't get the Bournemouth job, did he? Yeah.
Rightly too as well, yeah. Because he's sort of he lacks the qualifications for it. You know, I'd be interested to see what Jason Tindall does. Another JT, obviously.
Of course. Right, we all know about managers and managerial ego. My ears pricked up when I heard Pep Guardiola asking the rhetorical question, why are we so special? I think if you actually cut through the sort of tiresome manager speak, he really fancies it, doesn't he, Aid?
I think so, yeah. I mean, they're sort of extra determined this year because of their wrath against UEFA. I did feel it was an impressive performance against Real Madrid, as bad as Real Madrid were. I mean, if you catch Varane on that kind of off day And Zinedine Zidane, I don't think, should get off lightly, by the way, with that performance. It seemed like they went to the Etihad with no game plan at all. So they got what they deserved there. But City, to their credit, had a game plan. The players followed it well. And look, they should have won by more. So, yeah, he's got the bit between his teeth and would love, absolutely love it, in the words of Kevin Keegan, to go and win the Champions League, wouldn't he? I mean, blimey. But everything that we've said about City still stands. Fernandinho was nowhere near Benzema for that goal. And I felt that Benzema kind of gave their centre-halves a bit of a run-around in that game. He was real top class. They just didn't spend long enough pressurising this fragile City defence. Kyle Walker was good. You know, give them their dues. They played well on the night, but I still think that they have a fragility. And I wouldn't write off Lyon in a one-off game causing them problems. They've done it before, Lyon, albeit under a different coach, went to the Etihad and turned them over 2-1. I remember the game, didn't have much of the ball, Lyon, but they counter-pressed unbelievably well. And if they do the same again, who's to say that they can't get the similar result on neutral territory? So you say, yeah, they fancy it, but I still make City third or fourth favourites to win this competition.
Do you agree with that, Seb?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I wouldn't place them in the Bayern Munich category yet. I think this is kind of ground we've covered, in the sense that all roads lead to the issues with their defence. But I've been really impressed by, I think, the life in the side since the restart. You know, just the sort of the freshness of the ideas. I felt sort of, when it became obvious that Liverpool were going to win the title, it felt like Manchester City became a little bit dead behind the eyes, that they were sort of playing on autopilot. Now, the team that we've seen that's come out of the lockdown isn't without its flaws. I cover those. You know, there are still big issues with, you know, centre-half and, you know, with the kind of the consistency of the full-back play and also defensive midfield. But in terms of the originality of things like their angles, their runs, their off-the-ball movement, actually the general speed of their football, I've been so impressed. I've been so impressed. And so, you know, yeah, they have their caveats, but this is a dangerous, dangerous side. And, you know, just in the same way that we can make a case for Lyon causing them a bit of a problem, I mean, it wouldn't exactly be a shock if City could leave Bayern Munich with a bit of a bloody nose. They're in the discussion, without question.
Mm. We'll look in greater depth at Lyon probably in the Thursday edition. Were you surprised they saw off Juventus, Aid? And also, what does the fallout from that, you know, the Sarri sacking, what's that say about the nature of the modern game? Is it, you know, okay, Juventus have won Serie A, is it 9 times on the bounce? That's not enough, obviously, is it now?
No, it's not enough. Well, it's not enough for a team like Juventus, because it's almost a given now that they will win the league. So yeah, the Sarri fit didn't really click, did it? I thought he did take the team backwards, even though they won the title. And in that game against Lyon, they just lacked a bit of imagination. They looked a bit, bit tired, I think, in terms of the way they played. It's very much, if Ronaldo doesn't save the day, what else is there? So yeah, so Andrea Pirlo's got a big job on his hands, I guess. And yeah, it is the modern model, isn't it? Because teams up and down the land or around Europe keep changing their coaches and keep on winning, so it's not so important to build a dynasty as it used to be. On Lyon, I wasn't that surprised. I quite like Rudy Garcia as a tactician. I think that he's someone that's really flexible, changes his formation quite regularly, particularly in the Champions League, I've noticed. And look, he went with a great game plan, 3-5-2, and it worked. He left Dembele on the bench, which was incredibly brave, but introduced him at the right time. They've got good players. So, yeah, no, it wasn't a total shock to me. I still like Hussein Ouar. I still don't really know how to pronounce his name, but but I think he's a really good box-to-box player. Ouar, I really don't know. But
that one.
But go full West Countries.
Behalf of the West Country, I object to that, by the way.
Yeah, sorry, everybody over there in the West. But he's a really good box-to-box player and someone that, yeah, I'd like to see in the Premier League, actually.
Yeah, now I mentioned Andrea Pirlo, who, you know, obviously by common consent was a wonderful footballer to look at. Is his appointment after about 9 days as under 23 manager, a romantic dream, or a is he a sort of cynically inserted stopgap? You know, this talk, well, will Pep go there in a year's time? What do you think, Seb?
Yeah, I think you might have hit the nail on the head there, Mike. I think this is a kind of a temporary solution. I think it has its roots in Juventus's domination of Serie A. I think it's the kind of appointment you make if you have absolutely no respect for your native competition. which, to be fair, that's not hubris on their part. That's just, you know, it is what it is. They are utterly dominant. They win Serie A at Canter every year. And they can probably get away with inserting someone without any experience. I am surprised they didn't go for Maurizio Pochettino. I think he'd make a wonderful Juventus manager. I think they're at a stage where they need a rebuild. Their squad needs to be taken apart and rebuilt. And to do that, you need a manager with a real weight of personality. And Pochettino is your man. It's kind of what he did at Spurs. He sort of endured a tricky 6 months of tackling egos and jesting unwanted players out and, you know, dealing with the ructions that come from that. And at Juventus, it would be, you know, be different. I mean, there aren't many Yunus Kabuls at Juventus. It's not as easy as it was at Spurs, but it is a task for someone like him. With Pirlo, I don't know. I mean, I find it a little bit dislikable. I find it kind of, we were talking about John Terry. I find it very jobs for the boys. I find it to be quite a synthetic appointment in the sense of, you know, Pirlo has had this afterlife of, you know, he's stylish and fashionable and we all like him, and it's kind of not detracted, but it's sort of beside the point of what he was as a footballer. And I feel that this is culturally what we're moving towards in football a little bit, in the sense of, you know, it's the superficial stuff that matters rather than the coaching badges and
experience. It's all about the brand, isn't it, at Juventus?
Yeah, mate,
they see themselves as a fashion brand.
I completely agree.
And Pirlo's kind of cool, isn't he? I mean, yeah. it's also fashionable, isn't it, to go with the legend player. I mean, you're seeing it in the Premier League now with Solskjaer, Lampard, Arteta, not legend as such, but popular player. And they're all doing quite well, aren't they? So it's sort of in vogue to do that. And also Juventus are a very... They're a traditional club, aren't they? And you don't see many overseas managers taking over Juventus. I know that Deschamps did, but in the recent history, it's been Italians the whole way through. I think that seems to be quite important to them. So, yeah, look, we'll see. I mean, yeah, it's not the same as if I took my coaching badges this year, I'd be Southend United manager next year. Do you know what I mean? But it's not too far away from that. He's only really just taken an interest in coaching, and he's landed a huge, huge job. It's a gamble.
This is a harbinger for what happens in the future. If Andrea Agnelli gets sort of the European football dynamic that he wants, which is the kind of the ring-fence Super League, then this is the kind of coaching appointment that we're going to get used to, because it is going to be all about brand. Without the kind of the peril of relegation and the fear of lost revenue, it's going to be about fame, and it's going to be about sort of attracting the kind of audience that flocks around Andrea Pirlo's beard and his wonderful hair and all that kind of thing. And this is where I know I'm being a little bit fatalistic, but this is what I generally feel this is where the game is heading. It's not about nuts and bolts and mechanics and, you know, team structures. It's going to become more synthetic than
that. But to be a good brand, to be a successful brand, you've got to be a winning brand. And to be a winning brand, you still need a good tactician. I think you'd always need them. You'd always need a smart manager to look after.
Or do you just need
a
lot of money, Aid? I mean, you need both to be an optimal performer. But I think you can get away year to year with a kind of... sort of the Di Matteo scenario.
Yeah.
You gather the right amount of players in the right place at the right time, and you know, good things
in
tend to happen. And I think, yeah, that's true. Yeah.
Yeah, in a knockout competition. I don't know. I think in the proper Champions League format, or if you're talking towards going to a European Super League, then absolutely no. I think it becomes, everyone's rich, and it becomes even more important that you have the best coach in your technical area. But look, let's see. Pirlo might turn out to be a genius. You know, he was a pretty tidy player, wasn't he? So let's see what he's got tactically. He strikes me as very laid back. I did meet him once, and he was just, it just seemed really horizontally laid back. It was very chilled out. So you do wonder whether he'll be able to motivate the guys, because I genuinely feel, and this is from personal experience and from what you see of coaches around the world, I think energy is massive. And if your manager doesn't give off positive energy or lively energy or energize the players, it's difficult.
Yeah, you use the word synthetic, Seb, and I have to say, I think of that word when I think of PSG. That is a club in which the brand is all about the vanity purchase at vast amounts of money, and they're still unable to translate their domestic dominance into Champions League credibility. Given all that, one, is it a potential employer for Pochettino? And two, do you expect them to wheel Mbappe out against Atalanta?
Question two first. If they do, that's reckless. Atalanta are not to be trifled with as a team. Gasperini's created a miracle there. I actually quite like Atalanta to knock out PSG. And I don't think PSG can afford passengers. Mbappe, of course, at full fitness is a world-class footballer, but he cannot possibly be anything close to that on the basis of the injury he suffered in the French Cup final. Pochettino, I can see it being a landing spot for Pochettino eventually, because obviously he played there. He's got a great deal of affection for the club. I just hope he doesn't go there, because I just see it, and apologies if we have any really sensitive Paris Saint-Germain fans listening, but it's just a waste of time. Like it's for someone like Pochettino, he needs a project. He needs the opportunity to take a club from A to B. And Paris Saint-Germain, it isn't that. It's a, you're going to win everything that you want to win domestically, but just through sheer weight of your squad's quality. And it becomes then just the binary question of, did you win the Champions League? And I don't want that for Pochettino. I want him to work somewhere where he can actually create an identity and an era for himself. I mean, because we've almost forgotten that Thomas Tuchel is at Paris Saint-Germain. He's an excellent manager, just someone that sort of, would improve pretty much any club he moved to. And yet it's kind of beside the point. He's lost in the glare of the Neymar and the whatever else. It's not a footballing project. And Pochettino is at his core a football person. And so I'd much prefer to see him at a Bayern Munich, at a Juventus. Mm. He wouldn't go to Barcelona.
I've done this before on the pod, and I'll say it again. Are we not overrating Pochettino a little bit here? Like, we're elevating him to a status where he should be picking Bayern Munich over a PSG. But Juventus, maybe, I don't know if it's right for him. Pochettino didn't win stuff. He is a very good coach. I'm not denying that. But he didn't win anything. And the team did fall off the rails at Tottenham eventually. I'm not saying that was always
his fault. Was that because of him, Aid? Or was it because of the culture that was imposed upon him?
Quite possibly. And I think that he did work excellently in a difficult environment. I'm not saying that he isn't a very good coach. But for me, he's not proven. At elite level, Pochettino is still, would be a risk. And I just feel that Juventus or PSG he's not the first name in their thoughts. I just think here in this country, maybe we elevate Poch slightly above his true station. I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. But I think that there is logic to my argument in a way.
Mm. If we're talking about modern football, Seb, let's look at the other tie in the bottom half of the draw, which is probably the weaker half. We've got Red Bull Leipzig. They're playing Atletico Madrid without Timo Werner because he's gone to Chelsea.
Yeah.
They're talking about looking at their recruitment model again. They've been bullied into losing their best player because of the weight of Chelsea's money, haven't they? And they should really be playing for them in this match.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think about a month and a half ago, we dragged Ryan Fraser over the coals for something similar. And my opinion is pretty consistent on this. He should be there. He should be playing. This is RB Leipzig is a little bit of a different situation. When we talk about the first time in the history, it's a bit of a...
haven't got much of a history, have they, really?
Exactly that. However, if I was one of his teammates, if I was someone like, Konrad Leimer, for instance, you know, an excellent player who on the right day could go very deep into this competition, potentially even win it. It's not out of the realms of possibility. They're an excellent side, or at least they were with Werner at the top of their formation. I don't like it. I think it's kind of, I think it demonstrates kind of almost a sort of the dissipation of the old kind of team building idea that sort of, you know, groups of players achieve things together. And now we're left with this sort of, right, well, you know, no, superstars are underpin progress in the game. And, you know, we'll do what I want. We'll do what we want because we're the commodity in the sport. I don't like it. I can't agree with it. And I've heard the counter argument, which is that he wants to be ready for Chelsea's new season. I think it's a very weak argument. It's just like, well, okay, you know, good for you. The transfer's agreed. I find it very, very dislikable.
Come on, go and win it. Go and win it.
Well, I'm not sure I'd go that far because ideologically I've got some issues with what Leipzig are. I feel sorry for his teammates. I think kind of they've achieved this together and all of a sudden let's be honest, he's just walked out on them because he's got a better offer somewhere else. It's no more complicated than that.
Yeah, well, that's football, I'm afraid, isn't it? With that Atletico aid, I see them as potential winners of this tournament. There is a developing story, and we yet to know the full consequences of two positive tests for COVID. So that will develop as the days and the hours and the days go on. With Atletico, all being well, and let's hope it is well, do you see them as potential champions like I do?
Yeah, I think they're capable. Certainly, I see them as finalists. I'm a bit with Seb. I think PSG, they're out of match practice and Atalanta are a really brave side. So I could see Atalanta winning that. And I would certainly see the winner of Atletico and Leipzig beating the winner of the other quarterfinal. So yeah, I think Atletico, for me, will be finalists. That would be my tip. The reason is they're hard to beat again. Four defeats all season in La Liga. That takes some doing. They were superb, weren't they, against Liverpool? Mm. Two very different games. But I mean, Oblak was just was ridiculous. But I also felt in the first match that tactically Simeone really squeezed the life out of Liverpool. And I think he's capable of doing that against most teams. Loads of Champions League experience, of course, with Atletico Madrid. So, yeah, I think they've got a very good chance. But for me, I still can't look beyond Bayern Munich. But Atletico are getting towards the Atletico that they were under peak Simeone.
Yeah, actually, looking back at that Liverpool game, it seems like it was 100 years ago, doesn't it? It's amazing when you think about it. Let's look at the Europa League. Wolves are in Germany, their first European quarterfinal for 48 years against Sevilla. Is that a challenge too far, Seb?
I don't know. I mean, Wolves were very ropey against Olympiacos. Their penalty box took an absolute shelling and Rui Patricio made some excellent saves in that game. The one thing that makes me feel good about that, about their chance against Sevilla, is that Wolves have little pockets of class. Even when they're not playing well, they've always got a Neves through ball in their locker. They've got a little burst from Traoré. They've got, you know, a little bit of attacking imagination from Jimenez or Jota or, you know, Daniel Podence is another player who I really like. He's signed from Olympiacos, obviously, in January. He had an excellent game against them. Sevilla, hard to know where they're at because I did see their game against Roma and Roma were absolutely dreadful. So I don't know what their level is after the end of their season. But I would give Wolves a puncher's chance. I think they're in that very convenient situation where even when they're not kind of defending as well as they might do, they have that sort of, it's almost like an old Man United quality where they have good enough players whereby they can rely on doing some damage to the opposition under any circumstances. And I still like them. I mean, in any matchup, I like Wolves just because also they are built to counterattack. So any team that underestimates them, any team that sort of tries too hard to expose the frailties they may have seen in that Olympiacos game, well, you've got issues because then you've got Jota, you've got Traoré, you've got Jimenez, you've got Moutinho as well, remains just an outstanding player. If they click, they could win the tournament. But then equally, you could see them being eliminated. But I still like them. They remain my dark horse, Mike.
Yeah, Sevilla, you know, are in really good form, aren't they? I think it's 15 unbeaten in La Liga, I think 18 overall. They've already qualified for the Champions League. They finished fourth in La Liga with 10 clear of fifth. that side, obviously, there's a tradition within the club aid of winning the Europa League or its equivalent. Do you see Sevilla, you know, do we underestimate them? You know, we always think of La Liga and we just think of the big two.
We do, yeah, because they don't, they very rarely have a superstar player. The strength is ordinarily about the team, the collective. Technically, they always have a lot of sound players. They tend to be grisly at the back. Talking of them at the back, I think it could be a low-scoring game with Wolves. Clean sheets in five of their last six, Sevilla. And yeah, I don't see it being a particularly high-scoring tie. I'm interested in looking at Diego Carlos, centre-half, left-sided centre-half, been linked with Arsenal and a number of Premier League teams. So it'd be interesting to see how he fares in the game. Yeah, no, I think we do underestimate them because they've got that record in Europe where they win trophies. It's as simple as that. And they will believe that they're overwhelming favourites, I think, to beat Wolves. And then if they do come up against Manchester United in the next round, Sevilla, even though we would class them as huge underdogs, I don't think they would be overwhelmed by that challenge. I think the winner actually of the competition will probably be either United or Sevilla. I don't think Wolves just look too tired to me to go on and win this competition. I just think,
they look knackered, don't they?
That's the difference. And I think that United and Sevilla are slightly fresher.
Yeah, they'll come up against Julen Lopetegui, who turned down Wolves, lest we forget, in 2016. Wolves probably got the best of that deal because they recruited Nuno the following year. They obviously need to tie him down to a new contract as soon as, don't they? Because he's ready for a bigger club, isn't he?
I mean, he's certainly got the ability to manage a bigger club. I mean, I don't know. I don't know whether there's any agitating on his behalf, but absolutely, I think sort of the, not just the relationship between Nuno and his players, that's not the only important thing here. The pipeline between Jorge Mendes, Wolves and Nuno is also extremely important because that's been very successful, not just in the sense of the provision of talent, but Nuno has had players that he's been able to use, you know, really, really well. I mean, if you look at that squad, okay, Matinho may be a little bit of an exception, possibly Neves as well. There are very few there who you'd say, right, well, you are destined to, you know, to exist at the top of the table or to, you know, to compete in the latter stages of the Europa League. You take someone like Jimenez. Jimenez hadn't had a prolific season since he left South America or Central America. Should say he's Mexican, you know, and he's been sort of reborn as this as one of the best forwards on the continent. And you look throughout the side, and you look at players like Doherty, Cody, Bolly, Johnny, the fullback as well. He's an excellent player. Diogo Jota. It's like the sort of the metaphor of the analogy of Mendes has been able to give Nuno the right kind of soft clay. He's carved these pieces into what it, you know, cumulatively has become this really, really impressive side. Now, if he were to leave the club, you could replace him and Wolves have the budget to replace him with someone very impressive. Whether the chemistry and the alignment would exist in the same way, I don't know. So it's absolutely essential. He is Wolves at the moment.
What struck me, there was some images immediately after they qualified against Olympiacos, and it was, you know, the big group huddle, which usually, you know, they've become a bit of theatre, haven't they? But Nuno was making some points, and I looked at the players and their concentration, that they were looking really deeply at him. And it was obvious that the respect that they had for him, you know, was there and visible.
Oh, he's a scary character, isn't he? I'd listen to Nuno if he was talking to me. There's no way I'd look elsewhere and start to daydream. I don't think he'd tolerate it. Yeah, he's a big guy. I rate him. I think he's excellent. Seb summed it up. He's in an environment that works really well for him. All I think he can ask of the board is that they continue to show greater ambition year on year. Obviously, the likelihood now is that they'll be out of Europe. So they can probably have a real run at top four next season. And providing he can keep Traore and Jimenez, who else will he be allowed to bring in? That's the big question. But I don't see Nuno leaving. No chance, not at the moment.
Okay. You mentioned Traore there. As a fellow flying winger,
could I be any different?
Yeah. He has exactly the same physique.
What do you think of his pre-match ritual of having his arms baby oiled to prevent defenders grabbing onto him?
I love it. I love it. It's good. It's fine margins, isn't it? Marginal gains, that's the phrase, isn't it? Why not? And yeah, it's just weird that we sort of sometimes see it. You know, you think that could, that sort of thing could take place, you know, behind closed doors. But no, last minute baby oil on there. Why not? I mean, it's a bit like the tight fitting shirts, isn't it? To stop opponents tugging at you, that the rugby teams have gone for. I don't blame him, is the bottom line. And it's, yeah, I just like the fact that it's a bit different.
Smells nice, probably. That's what I mean. Right. The other Europa League tie of immediate significance for us, Manchester United against Copenhagen in Cologne on Monday night. Seb, do you start De Gea or retain Sergio Romero?
Romero, because Manchester United's incentive for winning the Europa League is gone. They're already in the Champions League next season. It's no longer important to them. Romero is a very serviceable backup keeper, but I think it's important to just temper the conversation around De Gea a little bit, because even the slightest mistake at the moment is going to be a national conversation. And I don't think that's particularly helpful. And I, you know, without the need to qualify for the Champions League through this competition, I don't think De Gea needs to be put in that position. I think he needs to be sat down for the rest of, well, not the summer, but summer/autumn until the new season begins, and just taken out of the spotlight, because that's the one, it's really the one negative on Manchester United's horizon at the moment. A lot of what Solskjaer is doing is being received very well. Now, the signings have gone well. Bruno Fernandes, of course, has played exceptionally. And yet De Gea is the dark cloud, unfortunately. And so in a game against someone like Copenhagen, where United, by all intents and purposes, for all intents and purposes, quite rightly, are a prohibitive favourite, why would you put him in a situation where the best possible outcome really for him is just to go unnoticed for the evening? It just makes no sense. Leave him out. Play Romero. Romero is certainly good enough. If United get eliminated by Copenhagen, it's not going to be because of Sergio Romero. Let's put it that way. It's a night to be to do a little bit of PR, I think.
Really. Back pages today, by the way. I don't know if you've seen them. A lot of them are about De Gea and this sort of three doesn't go into two when you chuck Henderson into the mix. So look, yeah, it's going to be interesting, because if he does pick De Gea, it's as if to say it's challenging him to prove himself. Which I think, given his long career to date, is maybe a bit unfair. But personally, I would, I think I said this before. I think United should have dropped him, and for form alone, I would pick Romero.
Well, we've got you, Aid. A couple of Arsenal issues that I'd just like to run past you. Are you surprised that they're apparently willing to let Ainsley Maitland-Niles go? And what about Lucas Torreira? He's been linked to AC Milan. Has Arsenal been a wasted opportunity for him and also the club?
I'll start with Torreira. I feel a little bit sorry for Lucas Torreira, because I thought he was really, really good at the outset. And then things started to level off for him at the end of last season. Physically, I think it got to him, the physicality of the Premier League, the relentlessness of it. And he became jaded. And then Unai Emery saw fit to misuse him basically as a sort of attacking midfielder, which was just bonkers. And his confidence went. And I think so from a football point of view, he's lost his way. He's not regained that confidence or presence. Also, off the pitch, I don't think he's settled in England, in London. So when you put those two things together, I just think it's a decent player who had potential to be really good, that it just didn't work out because of the way he was used. And his personality wasn't suited for the club or the country. So I think it's right to sell him. AC Milan, why not? Gazidis, I suppose, has got that influence there. As for Maitland-Niles, hand on heart, I've not been hugely sold on Maitland-Niles over the last couple of seasons, because I'm not sure what his best position is. And if his best position is fullback, I think he's got an awful lot of work to do still to become good enough to be first choice fullback for Arsenal. So I'm conflicted here, because he was excellent in the cup final and the cup semi-final, but hand on heart, I don't know if he's good enough to be a starter long-term in that position. So I actually feel for him, for his career, the benefit of his career, it might be better to move on, even though Arteta clearly doesn't really want to lose him for now. What's interesting here is that there appears to be a clash between Arteta and the board. Arteta sees use in him. The board see pound signs, and there seems to be a bit of a standoff, which isn't healthy. And I hope that they come to a decision pretty quickly and that it doesn't drag on and on. But for me, both players probably long term will be better elsewhere, and Arsenal can upgrade those positions in my opinion.
Okay, let's sort of jump nimbly across North London then, Seb. Spurs, Ryan Sessegnon. Again, talk of being loaned out to Ajax. I speak as someone who saw him come up through the England youth system, and he was a certainty the first time I saw him play. He has stalled at Spurs. Why?
Two reasons. First is probably the damage done by that Fulham season, where he... I think it's important to understand what Sessegnon is. He's not a Gareth Bale-like figure. He's a component within the side. He's a very, very smart footballer. He is someone that reads the play very well. He's someone that moves to the right positions at the right time. Now, without the continuity of the Fulham took away from him with all that sort of ridiculous summer transfer activity that during their first season back in the Premier League, he was a natural victim. At Spurs, he's had so little opportunity to kind of rediscover his equilibrium. I mean, just literally in terms of minutes on the pitch, he hasn't had an opportunity to play consistently with the cornerstone pieces of Tottenham's side, with, you know, Kane, Son, Alderweireld, any of the fullbacks. And so he's in this situation where, without being a kind of an individualist player, it's very difficult for someone like him, whose, you know, confidence has taken a hit and whose ego has been bruised, all that kind of thing. It's going to be very difficult for someone like him to make his case from the outside. I've just finished writing about this for 442, actually, and it's interesting because the solution in this situation is always, well, just loan him out somewhere and, you know, help him rediscover himself. And it's identical, even though they're very different players, it's identical to what happened to Gareth Bale. If you remember back to Harry Redknapp's first few months at the club, Bale was supposed to, you know, be sold to Nottingham Forest. He too was supposed to be loaned to Ajax at one point. And it's not the solution. It's like, that's just out of sight, out of mind. If you want a player like Sessegnon to succeed at a club like Spurs, he has to stay at Spurs and you have to integrate him. Because, Mike, I'm with you. I remember seeing him with the England age group players, in England age group teams. He's a fantastic footballer. He's a very impressive individual. He's very interesting to talk to, and he will succeed if the conditions around him are adjusted to suit him. And I think it'd be a very serious mistake for Spurs to bounce him out, because it doesn't serve the long term interest. It doesn't. It's the fast way to ensuring that he won't succeed at the club.
Okay, let's look at broader issues. The VAR changes. I looked at that. Good that referees are being encouraged to go to the TV monitors at last. I sense there'll probably be off the line chaos at penalties involving goalkeepers. But isn't the overriding feeling of it, Aid, that it's still about the referees protecting other referees?
Yeah, and the protecting referees aren't good enough. Simple as that.
Yeah,
the standards have never been lower, in my opinion, and that is the real issue here. I don't think they had a choice. I think FIFA have sort of, you know, used their will here to impose their way on the Premier League, and I don't think you'll find many Premier League fans disagreeing with the FIFA way. Let's go with the pitch side monitors. All I'll say on that is, please, let's just go straight to the monitor rather than, you know, fiddling around for 3 minutes and then being undecided, then sending a ref over to go and look at it. Let's just get them over there as soon as possible and get on with it. But yeah, the bigger problem for me is not VAR. It's not the technology. It's the people it's the people using it. And we need to raise standards dramatically. And the fact that it's gone so quiet at the moment in regards to personnel, refereeing personnel. Where's the story? I want to see stories of radical changes, within that organisation at Stockley Park, within the referees group. I want to see the elite group of referees and assistants shaken up. But again, for the 20th season in a row, it feels like it'll be same as. And these people are consistently making dreadful decisions. I think we need the new breed of referees as soon as possible. Other people need to be given a chance, in my view.
Yeah, I'd agree with that entirely. We're at that time in the show where it's get your opinions out. Seb, this is your chance to basically say what you feel.
Well, I had to think about this, Mike, and it's a long-term grievance, actually, about Paul Pogba. I've been thinking about it for quite a long time and kind of watching on silently to the way his Manchester United career has been covered and the tone of the coverage in the British press. There's this weird little immerta in the media whereby you're not allowed to sort of criticise other people and, you know, this weird sort of, oh, you know, don't criticise your colleagues. I think the way that Paul Pogba has been written about and reported on has been an absolute disgrace for a couple of years. In terms of, yes, he hasn't always enjoyed the best performances and sometimes his agent hasn't done him much good. But I think there are people, you know, in the press boxes who want to probably review some of their coverage, have a little bit of a think about some of the words used and to probably do better next time someone of Paul Pogba's profile turns up in the Premier League. It's not good. And I probably should have spoken about this a long time ago, but yeah, it's not very good. These are things that should be said out loud, I think.
Okay, well said. Aid.
Two things, if I may. First of all, can I just send a message out there to Newcastle fans? Can you please stop atting me into Premier League tweets? Because, it's doing my head. I can't see any legitimate messages that people are sending me. To put this into context, there's an article I wrote on West Bromwich Albion that the Premier League have tweeted out a couple of times, and Newcastle fans have just sabotaged it with abuse of the Premier League and its chief executive. So please, just leave me out of your grievance. Hey,
social media is nothing but reasonable aid, so like, I'm sure that's exactly what they'll be.
I just think that I am bored silly with that, and there is some absolute nonsensical posturing going on up there.
Yeah, I agree. So yeah, that is really irritating. The other thing that really is getting my goat at the moment is the images of people flocking to the seaside and on trains and seeing these packed beaches. Yet we're talking about going into an EFL season with no fans. There needs to be, surely, you know, some push. I mean, there's a lot of grievances I have with the EFL at the moment, but the EFL and football in general, they need to push harder, I think, lobby the government to find a way to get paying customers back in the grounds. You know, when I see the pictures of how close people are on the beaches, on trains, flooding off trains, we have to find a way to get fans back into Football League grounds, because it will be unsustainable for them to be behind closed doors until the new year. Even if it's limited, you know, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, it's better than nothing. And I feel that we need to be working much, much harder on pushing for that to happen. Because if not closing beaches, why are they closing football grounds, in my opinion?
Well, we're talking about leadership there, aren't we, Aid? And when it comes to governance, the EFL have an abysmal record. You know, even now, no one can be entirely certain which clubs will be playing in the Championship next season. Now, that's why I have to wonder whether the salary caps announced for Leagues 1 and 2 are enforceable. The PFA, with whom Gordon Taylor is still picking up his £2 million a year, by the way, they're making noises about legal challenges. Now, I understand the extent of the financial problems. Portsmouth, for instance, are losing £700,000 a month during the shutdown. All but two League Two clubs voted to be limited to spending £1.5 million a year. More significantly, seven League One clubs voted against being restricted to a budget of £2.5 million. Like them, evidently, I believe a one-size-fits-all approach is a charter for mediocrity. Within reason, you know, perhaps as a percentage of income, clubs should be allowed to invest as they see fit. Ambition isn't a dirty word. Where it is ruinous, and we've got to look at the Championship for that probably, the EFL have been found wanting. The game, quite simply, needs better leadership. Do you agree? I suspect many of you do. Please let me know. But first, Thanks once again for joining us here on the Football Writers Podcast.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing and context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.